Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is St. Louis on the Air.
I just couldn't deny any longer that I couldn't open my eyes. I had been in denial for that period of time. And I sat in the hospital bed and thought to myself, you know, I really can't open my eyes. I have been keeping a stiff upper lip and acting like I've got this all under control. But, you know, I really couldn't open my eyes. And it was a shocking time. One of the guides who I early on loved skiing with the most used to always say that it was like remote control skiing for him, and it is just a kick. I get such joy out of it. It's unbelievable.
I'm Sarah Fenske. On July 2nd, 1991, William M. Johnson was on a business trip to Atlanta when he and two colleagues were ambushed by a random shooter. His two colleagues were killed. He survived, but he was left permanently blind. That was 30 years ago this summer, and how William Johnson made peace with that new reality, and what for many of us might sound like a nightmare, is the subject of his inspiring new book, Snowblind. I couldn't put it down, and I am so happy the author is with us today to talk about it. So, Bill Johnson, welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm so happy to be here. And I appreciate the fact that you enjoyed the book.
I definitely did. I hope people will check this out. I learned so much. And I want you to take us through some of the highlights of this today. Let's start with July 2nd, 1991, since that's where your book starts. When did you realize that you'd been shot?
I didn't know immediately that I'd been shot. I certainly knew something had happened. We were walking down the street, and the attack came from, you know, the rear, and so there was no sensation of being violently attacked, but it simply felt like I got, I'll say, hit in the head with a baseball bat. I had heard pop, 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 which, being July the 2nd, I assumed were some firecrackers in downtown Atlanta, but of course, they were gunshots, and as I turned my head, I was, you know, struck and shot right through the temples. Mm-hmm. You know, as it turns out, I'm very thankful that I turned my head. I'm sure been worse damage.
It's almost miraculous that you survived this, a bullet just going through your head.
It really is. It's amazing. You ask when I knew I'd been shot, and it was probably I can't really pinpoint it exactly. A doctor, of course, told me the whole experience when I was in the hospital, but the immediate feeling, other than being hit in the head, was just an excruciating pain in my eyes. And there's a picture on a website at authorwilliamjohnson.com from the Atlanta paper, I believe, with me on a gurney with my hands over my eyes. The pain of the light was just terrible. And I knew at the time I was not going to ever see again. And I had a thought that I just needed to remain conscious and I would survive, that if I lost consciousness, I didn't know what had happened to me, but I would likely be dead.
And so you understood at that point that you had been blinded by this. Did you have any sense of the implications of that, of what it would mean to adjust to life going forward without your sight?
Oh, gosh, no. Not at all. And, you know, you can imagine I was in shock, I'm sure, and, you know, medical people would know better what kind of shape I was in. That thought was, you know, not of course very well thought out, not very deep, not very conscious, frankly, but no. And as I woke up later in the hospital and, you know, events were explained to me, I had no idea you know, what it really meant. I didn't have experience particularly dealing or working or living closely with people with disabilities of any sort. Certainly not blindness.
And I do want to address something directly, because you address this in the book. You don't use euphemisms. You make a point of saying you are blind. Why do you prefer that to some of these vague words we might use, like lost his eyesight or visually impaired?
Yeah. You know, I just think it describes exactly what I am. And as you read, I had that feeling immediately in the hospital. People that I knew, friends, family, whoever would come, and they would, you know, always, of course, make some reference to, oh, you know, when you could, well, they wouldn't say when you could see, but, you know, they mm-hmm. would say something about visually impaired or lack of sight or this or that or whatever. And I don't know. It just felt normal and natural to me to just confront it head on. And I would generally then kind of come up with a sentence in response to them and use the word blind in it. And
get them comfortable with it.
Yes, to try to get them comfortable, exactly. And it sounded harsh. It sounded harsh to me, and I think it did to them as well. But I think it was the right thing.
Hmm. So, Bill, I want to make clear for our listeners to orient them in this story. When this happened, you were in a more complicated situation than many people might have been. You were divorced. You had young kids, kids that were very precious to you. You wanted to see going forward, but you lived alone. You were also used to traveling for work, just all these things that made it even harder to be blind. When did you reach the point of realizing, wow, your entire life as you knew it had just changed overnight?
Well, it was, really shortly before I got out of the hospital. I wrote that, you know, that during the time of, I was in the hospital a total of about 3 weeks. Some of that I was unconscious, and much of it I was, you know, and reasonably conscious, medicated, but, you know, dealing with nurses and people were doing things for me. Somebody else always had an idea that to get me to physical therapy or to a ophthalmologist or, you know, whatever, the medical care, somebody else was thinking about all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wasn't focusing too much on the future.
Hmm.
There was a day when I think it kind of crashed in on me, which was fairly emotional for me. And fortunately, I just couldn't deny any longer that I couldn't open my eyes. I had been in denial for that period of time. And I sat in the hospital bed and thought to myself, you know, I really can't open my eyes. I have been keeping a stiff upper lip and acting like I've got this all under control. But, you know, I really couldn't open my eyes. And mm-hmm. it was a shocking time.
So your acceptance seemed to come relatively early and without a lot of cursing God or self-pity. You were just determined to go on with things. And I was so shocked at the point where when they finally let you out of the hospital, you know, you were sent back to St. Louis after some time at Barnes. You were able to move home. And you decided to move home by yourself rather than live with your parents. And you do a great job in the book of just walking through all the complications that followed uh-huh. that decision. I had never thought about how many things might change. You had a great story about all you wanted was just a can of pork and beans for dinner. Walk us through what that took in those early days to even figure out how to have that.
Well, yeah, and it is funny, and I fortunately was always able to laugh at some of the things that were happening. Some of them were frustrating at the point in time, but I wanted a can of pork and beans, and I went in the cupboard in my kitchen, and, you know, I guess I figured I could find a pan, I could get it heated up, but when I reached for the can of pork and beans, I grabbed a can, and then I realized I didn't have the slightest idea if it was pork and beans, green beans, tomato sauce, or anything else that came in a can, and just decided to open one up, which happened to be green beans, and put it down the garbage disposal and tried another one, and I came across the pork and beans right away.
You know, so. And one of the complications of this, which you didn't make a big deal about, you covered it almost in an aside a bit later, you had also lost your sense of smell at the point when this bullet cut through your head.
That is true. And it took me several, two, 3 months to even figure that out. I guess I say that I had always had allergies, and maybe I didn't have such a good sense of smell in the first place, but I did absolutely, I was able to smell stuff up until the shooting, and that didn't help.
so many things, just so complicated. I mean, everything from when your mail came, that you had to ask people for help to figure out what was a bill, and you know, how to even walk down the street. You ended up seeking more intensive help at a rehabilitation center in Arkansas. This is called Lion's World, just a fascinating place. And you make it clear in the book that you really resisted that at first. Why was that something that you didn't want to just go for?
Well, I wanted to learn what I needed to learn. I, as you mentioned, I was committed to return into the life with my young kids, to my job, which had been going very well, immediately preceding this. And I really had a great life. I really, really wanted to get back to my life. My big issue with Lion's World in the state of Missouri was that they wanted me to commit to a year. They were willing to pay in terms of occupational therapy for me to go down there, but they wanted a one-year commitment. And with the kind of work I did, which was I was a management consultant. It was client-based work and a fairly entrepreneurial setting. I didn't think my professional life would be there after a year. I didn't think my relationship with my kids would be there after a year. Hmm. That was really the only issue. I wanted to learn it all. I was in a big, big hurry.
You were in a hurry. I mean, they ultimately let you do this in less than a year. And it sounds like you learned so much in the months that you were there.
Yeah, the state of Missouri was very flexible. I've got to, say, I really appreciate it. But yeah, we agreed on some things I needed to learn, a certain skill level with, orientation and mobility, which is walking with a cane, with Braille, and with what I'll call a talking computer, an adaptive computer for people that are blind or visually impaired. Hmm. Those were the skills I really needed for my life, to go back to work, to, manage a household. And we agreed that if I reached a certain proficiency that the state of Missouri would be happy, and I'd be happy, and whenever that was.
Hmm. We're talking today to Bill Johnson, also known as William M. Johnson, the author of Snowblind, Recovering After a Random Shooting. It's a great memoir that just gives the step-by-step of what happened as he relearned to live life as a blind man. Now, Bill, there's this really interesting scene when you're there at this rehabilitation center in Arkansas. You have a roommate, Majid, and he's much more of a pessimist about your situation. He says, "Mr. Johnson, you are so naive. People do not like blind people. They will never give you your job back. Employers are scared of blind people at work. They think they can't do anything, that they just create problems. Blind people don't fit in with other workers, and we cost them money. They can't even get rid of us because of the government." Now, in your case, he was absolutely wrong about your employer. You returned to this career. Do you think he had a point about the bigger picture?
Just a bit of a point. That's not been my experience at all. As I said, I was very fortunate. I was employed with KPMG. And, although in my mind it sometimes appeared that there was a few hurdles to getting back to work, in general, they welcomed me to come back and pursue my same career or others. And what I wanted to do was come back into the same job.
Do you think you had an advantage there, that you'd already been doing this job? You had an MBA. You're doing well in your field versus somebody who maybe was blinded at age 5.
That's correct. I do recognize I had a lot of advantages in life. Excuse me. I had an education, a career. I had grown up and lived for 40 years seeing the world, and I did have a life to kind of go back to. But I still disagree that people who are blind or visually impaired. And there is a whole range. I mean, I am totally blind, but I soon learned many, many, many of the people that we may consider to be blind are actually visually impaired and have to some degree of functional vision. Mm-hmm. Functional vision. There are many, many, many skills that blind people can learn, jobs that blind people can do, call center being one of them. You know, as I worked and visited clients again around North America, I would often, you know, the people that were my clients, excuse me, would, you know, often introduce me to somebody at their company who was also blind. And, you know, and it was heartwarming to me. It was, you know, great. I was happy to meet somebody else. And so, no, I kind of disagree. I think Madge had some experiences in his life that he blamed on his blindness that might have been due to some other things. But
Speaking of your work at KPMG, we got a call from a woman named Adriana who says that she used to know you. You guys were colleagues there. She says she visited you at the hospital, and she told us that she thinks of you and your wife, Jenny, often, and she was excited to hear that you were on, and she hopes that you were well. And that's actually a perfect transition to something that we have to talk about with you. And that's the love story here. If you'd never been blinded in this shooting, you would have never met your wife, Jenny. She worked for the neurosurgery department at Barnes. When did things shift from her being this friendly voice at your doctor's office to being your love interest?
Well, it was a couple months after I was home from the hospital. She was called a nurse coordinator. She was a representative from the Department of Neurosurgery that, you know, came around to visit me in the room, somewhat like rounds, but she was not a doctor. You know, as I described, she, you know, with just a very friendly voice, she first knocked on the door and I said, "Who is it?" And she said, "Virginia." And my response was, "Oh, Virginia, is there really is a Santa Claus?" And
I bet she loved that.
You know, yeah, and I was kind of a cut up and she tolerated that. But yeah, she was always honest with me. She was certainly friendly and helpful. And then she was the contact I was given with the Department of Neurosurgery. So we had reasons to be in touch with each other, and I just always found her. I always looked forward to talking to her. I don't know that I had this in mind, so I'm not going to say I tricked her, but one day when I was home and wondering what I was going to do for dinner, and I got to thinking, and I ended up, And maybe the thought to call her came first, but I was talking to her on the phone and I just bluntly asked her, "What are you doing for dinner tonight?" And she kind of sputtered in surprise, and we ended up going out to dinner, and you know, one thing led to another, and by Thanksgiving we were seeing each other pretty regularly.
Well, so it wasn't just love. You also found or refound your love of skiing. And your descriptions of skiing blind are some of the best parts of this book. It's so amazing how this works. And yet, as I'm just blown away by what you were able to do skiing, you say the guides for blind skiers actually have the harder job. If you could just briefly explain to our listeners how this works.
Well, thank you. I had somehow in 1982 or three, one of the few ski trips I had taken since college, I apparently had seen a blind skier in Aspen, and it's kind of amazing. So I made some phone calls, and Ginny and I went out to Aspen, and it was actually over Valentine's Day just the following year. So basically a guide skis behind me and says left, right, you know, hold your necks right, hold it, left, right. And, you know, skis very closely to me, right on my ski tips, in fact, and has to think ahead, has to look at the other people that are out there and plan our course down the mountain. One of the guides who I early on loved skiing with the most used to always say that it was like remote control skiing. for him. And he would, you know, further say, you know, if I can lend you my eyes and we both have a great time, why wouldn't I do this? And, you know, it is just a kick. I get such joy out of it. It's unbelievable.
Well, these skiing passages, I want to recommend anybody who's interested in skiing to read how Bill describes this. It's just great. And Bill, in our final minute, you close this book with a single sentence that's so full of hope and joy. You write, "There is always a little light." Is that the thought that you want to leave readers with in this memoir of your life?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I say this is a matter of living life on life's terms for me. And I hope that anybody that reads the book can, you know, gain a little strength and then hope and a little courage to go on and do, you know, what needs to be done, what's in front of you to take care of yourself. And if some people can benefit from reading this, I'll just be thrilled.
Well, highly recommend this book. It's set for release next week. Pre-orders are already available. That's at authorwilliamjohnson.com/book. We'll also get a link on our website, stlpr.org. Bill, I couldn't help but wonder, are you planning to do an audiobook version for people who are blind?
I have been editing the audiobook version, you know, over the last 2 or 3 days, which was great preparation for me to do your show, to remind myself what all I had written. And I will say, if I could throw it in,
sure,
there are several copies at the Webster Groves Bookshop here in Webster Groves, Missouri. So,
oh, that's terrific. So people can get this today. They don't need to even do the pre-order if they're dying to go out and get a copy.
That's correct. And if too many people go get it today, my phone will ring and I've got more at home. So I'll get them up there.
That is great. Well, Bill Johnson, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this story.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.